Welcome everybody for unfortunately everything good must come to an end, and like all you football fans out there, we have one more week of football. The 2025-26 season is a week away from coming to an end, and this will be our last show due to the fact that WJR is broadcasting the big game next week, which is quite a coup for our station. So, you know, what a year it's been, Alex. I mean, there are so many stories that individually would dominate a football season. But so many of them happened this year. And it's just been wonderful to share the time with you. Your knowledge for someone at this stage of your career is unparalleled. And I hope we get to do it again. But first and foremost, welcome all the listeners, and what a year it's been. What a year.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, this has just been such a fun season. It's been great to be able to, you know, come and talk to you about it every weekend from here on out. Just both, you know, college, high school, and the NFL levels, there's been so many great teams and storylines and games this year. Really, it's just one of the most fun seasons in recent memory. It's a little bittersweet that it's coming to an end, but, you know, it has to get capped off sometime with a championship, right? And luckily, at least the offseason, we're getting into the interesting part of the NFL and college offseason here with all the coach hirings, some new GM hirings. Yeah. Free and seen the draft I've had, so we're not truly in the dark days yet where we have no content, like, you know, in June or July, but it is just sad, and the weekends do get a little more boring once the sport wraps up.
Yeah, you're right, it's coming to an end as far as the games go, but the beauty of football in general, the NFL in particular, is that there is no off season. I mean, maybe the last week of June, maybe the week of the 4th of July is, if there is a dead period, that would be it. But the NFL in particular, and college football as well, but the NFL has done a masterful job of being relevant 12 months a year. I mean, there is something significant literally happening every single month. And it's why football is America's passion. And it is at every level, at the youth level, middle school, high school, small college, you know, division one, two, three, and certainly at the NFL level. It is America's passion, because nothing unifies a community, a fan base, a city, a market, a state, like the game of football. It's remarkable. And as you and I have talked about so many times, it's not only the ultimate team sport, but no sport, you know, sort of represents life, is such a microcosm of life like the game of football. It takes a team, it takes a family. You're going to struggle, you're going to get knocked down, but if you get up and you do it, you know, in a unified way, leaning on support from each other, you can be successful. And I don't think we ever saw that play out on the football field as we did this past season.
Yeah, completely. I mean, it really is just the best sport. It is my cousin for life. So, and it is a national pastime. And, you know, part of that reason is, like how you said, the NFL's calendar is just something that it's just masterfully constructed, right? There's something every month. We're going to have the Super Bowl wrap up, then going to have free agency ahead of us. And we have all the combine and draft buzz happening. And then even in May, you know, in recent years, the whole making a media event out of releasing the schedule before, like the fact that it's crazy that, and, you know, I will be tuning into it no matter what, because you're so thirsty for content at the time. But yeah, just the sport itself is just so amazing and so entertaining. It's such a shame that, you know, the best one is on for the shortest amount of time throughout the year and is, you know, kind of stuck in this little place in the fall. But, you know, that's just one, the scarcity is why you love it at the end of the day.
No question. And we're just a short time removed from the final chapter to a story that I really believe, as we look back over the years, may be the greatest sports story of our lifetime. And I'm talking about the Indiana Hoosiers and Kurt Cignetti. Because if 3 or 4 years ago, anyone took a script to Hollywood and said, okay, I got this football story, here's how it plays out, they would have laughed at you and they would have sent you to the fiction room, all right, and said, you know, make a short out of it, knock yourself out. but it's so improbable. It's so unexpected. It's every analogy adjective that is good in life played out with that story by Coach Cignetti. And I don't think we'll ever see anything like it again, because when you consider, by every metric, measurement, what have you, Indiana University football was the worst college football program in history. And here, this guy, and I have a fondness for the Cignetti family, being from Western Pennsylvania as they are, as I am. I followed his dad. I had met his dad at a couple football related events. He was the head coach at West Virginia in the 70s, actually followed Bobby Bowden there, had a great career at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, which is a powerhouse Division II program in Pennsylvania, much like, you know, the Ferris States and the Saginaw Valleys and the Grand Valleys of our state, very comparable program. And to see what he did, the way he did it, is just remarkable. It's remarkable. And I loved his comment. I'm not sure when he made it, but it was about him being interested perhaps in some of the big job openings this year. You know, one of the powerhouses. And he just very appropriately said, powerhouses? We're the powerhouse.
Yeah. You know,
basically, why would I want to go to where I already am, so to speak? So just remarkable. And in a football crazed town and state like Michigan, it not only gives us something to marvel at, but it makes the bar that much higher for Michigan State, for Michigan, for all the D2 schools, for even the high schools, that you can get it done quickly. And IU is the example.
Yeah, certainly sets a high bar and standard. A lot of coaches are not going to have the excuse anymore of, you know, oh, we just need a few seasons to, like, get our guys in place and really let them settle. And because Cignetti made the playoffs in his first year at Indiana and then, you know, went on this undefeated run. So it can happen really quickly and just shows. I mean, you talk about a guy like Cignetti. This guy has an eye for talent. Most of the guys in Indiana, they weren't really highly recruited, but even just goes back in time. When he was at Alabama working under Nick Saban, he was also the recruiting coordinator there. And if you look at the players they got from that stretch from 2007 to 2010, you know, there are a lot of guys who are sitting there and they're, you know, Heisman winners. They're like runner-ups or first-round draft picks. You have like Julio Jones, Mark Ingram and all that. He was really the driving force in all that recruiting, and just shows, and that's why he's won at every level, because ultimately it is the players you have on the field, right?
Right.
So that's really what Cignetti's kind of calling card has been. And then he's done a great job implementing a system that, you know, he figured out the portal and he figured out a good way to teach it. He practices different. They're slightly shorter than most practices are. They spend more time in the meeting room. Don't go full contact. He's a really smart coach, and I think he's also just adapted really well to this modern state of college football, and it shows.
Yeah, and it is about talent. It is about players and recruiting. And it's not only about the players you see on the field on Sunday at a program like Alabama where he had success. And obviously at Indiana, it's about the scout teams. It's about the teams that make practices even more difficult than games at times. And his success is unparalleled. And we got an incredibly special guest coming up after the break. And I'm going to let the listeners in the football world in on something. Kurt Cignetti wasn't the first coach that should have used the phrase, Google me, I win. We have one in the state of Michigan that should have used that years ago, because no one personifies winning more than our guest after the break. This is Gridiron Rap on WJR, the great voice of the Great Lakes. Welcome back to Gridiron Rap. And Alex, I know you did some listening to our last segment, but just being, you know, relatively young in this sports journalism world, but very up to speed on football, you know, your impression of Coach and what he's done has to echo and share in the same, you know, light as mine.
Yeah, completely. It does. I mean, it's been one of the most impressive runs in the game for the past few years, and especially on the offense side of the ball, which I'd like to ask Coach a question about, because for those who don't know, this year, Ferris State, they averaged 52.8 points a game on offense and averaged over 313 on the ground yards. And I was just wondering, Coach, what is your guys' kind of general offensive philosophy, and how do you teach that to your players and instill that in them?
Oh, man, it was a wild year. We scored the most points in the history of college football this year. You know, but we had 16 games, but averaging, you know, 52.8 yards or points per game for 16 games is pretty wild. But so going back to last spring, we lost five offensive starters. So we won the national championship in 2024. We lost five offensive starters to the portal. So, obviously, Trinidad Chambliss to Ole Miss. We lost an offensive lineman to Michigan, an offensive lineman to Iowa, a running back to West Virginia, and a receiver to North Texas. So, we lost five of our best players. And so, I'm like, oh, my gosh. I mean, this could be like, you know, it might – you know, take us down, you know, this could be tragic for us. And we came back and, you know, part of it stems from a system where obviously you have to have a great offensive line ever, you know, every time you're going to be an efficient offense. And so it starts with them. We had a great offensive line this year. You know, and so they plugged in and played great. We had a redshirt freshman quarterback and redshirt sophomore quarterback that we run the quarterback a lot. So between those two guys, they rush for 2,000 yards, quarterbacks, which is crazy. And then we, you know, had great versatility. You know, I mean, obviously you mentioned the rushing yardage, but, you know, we also were, you know, an explosive offense that could, you know, score quickly with, you know, the deep ball. So all in all, you know, the philosophy is to, you know, we call it the multiple option spread system. There's a lot of reads involved, spreading the field, using vertical pass games, using a lot of motions and deceptions and reads. And, you know, there's a lot to it. But my offensive coordinators, my oldest son, Steven East, and he's done a really nice job of, you know, just creating really cool offensive schemes. And it's been working.
That's one of the beauties of your program, Coach, is that, you know, it not only figuratively is a family affair, but literally it is. And
yeah,
that's special. That's got to be so rewarding for you.
Yeah, it's awesome. My nephew's my defensive coordinator. So a son that's an offensive coordinator, and nephew whose name is the same as me, Tony Anise, is my defensive coordinator, and he does a miraculous job. Our defense, that's another big part of having a great offense is, you know, when the defense gets, you know, takeaways, sometimes they score, sometimes they give a short field. Yeah. At the very least, you know, they don't let people control the ball on us. And so it gives us an opportunity to, you know, get the ball and you know, execute our system. But, and then, yeah, my youngest son, Anthony's my inside receiver coach. So, yeah, there's four nieces on the staff, so it's pretty pretty unique for sure.
And you know, the one thing I've thought about when it comes to coaching, and in some respects, I'm most familiar with the high school level, obviously, with my son being a head coach at Holly High School, and you know, both my boys haven't played D2, D3. Is the impact, as you stated, Coach, so eloquently earlier, the impact you have on the lives of these young men. And I love the fact that my son's a high school coach, because the impact that you have already had on high school kids from Montrose, from Pioneer, from Tennyson, from Muskegon, and then now at Grand Rapids Junior College and then at Ferris is it's incomprehensible, really, when you think it's not just the young man that you impact, but it's his family and the generations of families. And I can't imagine anything more rewarding than when your former players come back or you see it, as you just mentioned, succeeding not only in their career, but in life as great fathers, as great husbands, as great family members, as great community members. I mean, I literally have goosebumps right now as I'm sharing this, because what a greater gift, what a greater legacy could anyone have than to give back in the way that you have with all of your players over the years?
Yeah, you know, I always say to people, you know, teachers, not just coaches, but teachers,
right,
and coaches, they impact more lives in 1 year than an average person does in a lifetime. Just yeah. Because, you know, I was a high school teacher for 25 years. So mm-hmm. I saw great teachers in all those classrooms that you mentioned, you know, being in the high school. And you know, they're so committed to young people. And, you know, when you change a person's life for the better, I mean, you're changing the world, you know, and you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of young people that, you know, come from disadvantaged backgrounds, and, right. and they need to be uplifted. You know, they need that mm-hmm. love, back to the love. But, and you see teachers teaching in classrooms that are just, you know, having given their heart and soul to help young people be successful. And, right. and that's how we operate. Like, when I hire my staff, I don't even talk X's and O's with them. I'm just saying, how committed are you going to be to a young person? Because yeah. that's the ultimate, you know? I mean, if you're committed to a young person, I mean, we can teach you, you know, what we want to do on the practice field, you know, but,
right.
you know, at the end of the day, there's a lot of young people that are really vulnerable and really in need to just have somebody love them and help them through challenging times. And if you're willing to do that, you know, you're willing to, you know, basically make a, you know, a change in how people live their life. And that's really important.
That is incredible, Coach. And I've never heard it stated so well and eloquently and so genuinely, and it's so true. And as you were sharing that, it reminded me of a dear friend of mine who your path may or may not have crossed over the years. Former Lions head coach Rod Marinelli, who grew up in California, had a very tumultuous childhood when he was in high school, actually had to live at the stadium for a few weeks. And he will tell you to this day, and has said it numerous times, he echoed what you just said. He said, the greatest resource our country has are our high school coaches and teachers because of the yeah. impact they can have on young people. And Rod will tell you that if it wasn't for a high school English teacher, he was failing a class. And if he failed it, if he continued down the path he was heading, he would not have qualified to go to college. And this teacher knew the situation, knew his family situation, basically took him in and said, if you'll do the work, I will tutor you after school for as long as it takes. That's what happened. Rod passed the class, ended up going to Cal Lutheran on football and wrestling scholarship, was a division, I believe it was Division II back then. He was on the same All-American team as Walter Payton, worked his way up the ladder, and he's retired, but he's still having coaching clinics for college coaches, for high school coaches. But you were right, and you are a personification of that reality when you consider the impact that you have had on so many people. So thank you for that. And before we wrap up, I hope we have a, you know, some good update news on your indoor facility. Anything you want to share about that, Coach?
No, we're still pushing it hard. You know, I mean, it takes yeah. a lot of people, not just necessarily, you know, Ferris alumni right. from the football program, but just Ferris alums from, you know, just from any program, you know, whether it's yeah. optometry or pharmacy or yep. there are a lot of people that probably, you know, have the means to help. And that's what it takes. It just takes a lot of people who are willing to help us. And,
yeah.
and you know, our president, we got a great president, Dr. Bill Pink, and and he's pushing hard. So I feel good about it. I think we're making a lot of progress, and you know, it'll probably happen once I'm too old to coach anymore, but we'll see. Yeah. That's how it normally works for me.
Well, I can say this, and I know you're a very modest human being, very humble, and I believe that's just an indication of your why you're so successful. But nothing has brought Ferris more recognition nationally than your football program. And with that, the enrollment increases, the contributions to the entire university, every educational department increases. It does so much for the entire university that I hope people realize that, because, you know, you're not just helping a football team when you consider helping Coach Anise get this indoor facility. You're helping the whole university, and most importantly, you're helping the young people that Coach Anise has so eloquently said are our future. So Tony, I can't thank you enough for joining us. We're here to help you any way we can, and continued success. And please know what an incredible impact you're having on these young people. The game of football, certainly in the state of Michigan, but nationally. We salute you, and we wish you nothing but continued success.
I appreciate you having me. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. And you are listening to WJR Gridiron Wrap 760, the great voice of the Great Lakes. Welcome back to Gridiron Wrap, and thanks again to Coach Anise from Ferris State. You know, arguably the best coach in America. I mean, I don't think there's any way you could have any argument about that. What he's done at Ferris State, what he did prior to that, is remarkable. And we are very fortunate to have our next guest in, speaking of football and the fact that football season, even though it's over on the field, it's certainly not over when it comes to recruiting and what's happening at the major college level. Alan, welcome to the show. Alex is very familiar with your incredible work for 247 Sports and for the Detroit News. So I'll let Alex take the mic and welcome you officially to the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us, Alan. Yeah, I want to lead off some questions. We have two new coaching staffs, and, you know, Whittingham and Fitzgerald at Michigan State. I was wondering if you could just go in and talk about kind of their philosophies and what to expect out of both staffs as recruiters.
Yeah, before I even start that, I should say my first assignment as a 19-year-old just starting was to go to Muskegon High School and interview some recruits there, and the head coach was Tony Anise. So
small world.
Yeah, so cool to still keep in touch with him. So cool to be right after him. But yeah, I think the interesting thing about Michigan and Michigan State with this coaching change is you have two coaches who I almost could say the same thing about both. They're both built on this very kind of, you know, old school, and I mean that in a good way, mentality, mm-hmm. traditional, built on values, built on toughness. They both played linebacker. Everything that you would expect in a team captain, Mike linebacker type of guy, they bring that mentality to the head coaching position. So you get two guys who I think are very, very similar in their approach. And when it came to the transfer portal, I think, you know, Coach Fitzgerald probably had a few more boxes he needed to check off, had a few more needs, a few more guys leave. And luckily for him, he got a little bit of a head start on that as opposed to Coach Whittingham, who came in a little bit later. And I thought Coach Fitz and his staff, and now when you talk about the transfer portal, it's all hands on deck. So you have to give credit to Coach Fitz because he was doing it by himself for a little bit. But GM Brian Gasser did a fantastic job. Coaches that he assembled did a great job. You see a lot of their connections. Hank Poteet hired as cornerbacks coach. He brings in Trey Bell from Iowa State. You know, there's connections out east to UConn. They get, you know, transfers from UConn. So you see that, and then certainly with Michigan, same thing, where you see some of the top transfers were guys who were either committed and signed to Utah or were already players on the team. So that helped. But you see both teams attacking depth, both teams needing, you know, interestingly enough, you know, depth at quarterback. So you saw them both take quarterbacks who. Come in late and you have to try to fill needs, and get starters. But I think that both staff did a tremendous job.
Yeah, that's great. And talk about the class that they helped retain when they both came in. Both took a quarterback from the state of Michigan, with Michigan State getting Cade Kaufman and then Michigan getting Tommy Carr. Can you tell us a little bit about both of them as players and what to expect from them down the line?
Yeah, so, slightly different situations there, where I think Cade, Michigan State got him committed. And I had to hang on a little bit towards the end when there was a coaching change, where Michigan was able to take Tommy late. There was some real healthy debate when you talk to coaches across the state and people who had seen them play about who was better. I actually think that's a good thing. It wasn't clear. They're both really good. Cade came into his own as a senior. First year starting was his junior year. First year with a new staff at East Kentwood. Played really, really well, but I thought he took a giant leap as a senior. Took a team that was, I think 5-4, just kind of snuck into the playoffs his junior year, and they're in the semis as a senior. And I thought he was as good of a player as anybody in the state, and knew he could throw the football. But if you watch some of the runs he broke in their playoff run, a lot more mobile and athletic than people think. Very, very cerebral. Probably gets overused a little bit when you talk about intangibles, but he really is a guy who has that great head on his shoulders. And you talk to the staff at East Kentwood, and they were the same staff at Detroit King who coached Dante Moore, and they speak so highly of his ability to process and make decisions and his leadership off the field. Tommy, on the other hand, I think he's really kind of grown into himself. He was this athletic, skinny, wiry kid who started to fill his frame in. And, obviously his brother CJ is doing really well at Notre Dame. When you talk to people around the family, they say Tommy's the better athlete, better peer athlete, a little more mobile and escape pressure a little bit more. And then still has that kind of similar thing. When you grow up in a football family, there's just some things instilled in you that that Tommy has. So really, really good take, I think, for Michigan late in the cycle. Their other quarterback commit had a season-ending injury. They needed to take someone at quarterback, and I thought that was a really, really good late take.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said there. I thought it was great. And then to kind of change directions a little bit, a few weeks ago, you wrote a great article on 24/7 about Liam Danitz and his kind of transfer journey. I was wondering if you'd talk about him a little bit and tell a story on air.
Yeah, so, very under-recruited out of Ogemaw Heights. But, when we say under-recruited, it sounds like everybody missed. He just was a guy who hadn't bloomed yet. So, 6'4", but skinny, wiry at that time also. Fast, but played some running back. I don't think schools were sure what he was. Didn't go to a bunch of things. Ogemaw Heights isn't a school that a lot of Big Ten Power Four schools will go through. So to his credit, went to Hope for camp. Peter Sturzman on that staff do a great job. Took him, developed him. And the interesting thing about him was that he ran track at Hope and didn't just run it, but was an All-American. And even as he added the weight, he's now 6'5", 230. He ran 10.55 in the 100, which is faster than a lot of Big Ten receivers.
That's honestly, what Xavier Worthy ran in high school, yeah. I believe, right? Yeah.
Exactly. It's really, really fast. And then almost the more impressive time, he ran 29.2 in the 200, so he could maintain the speed for 200. And, 15 sacks, 21 tackles for loss. Just enter the portal. When I talked to him, he thought maybe, when he first went in, I could transfer up to D2, go to Ferris, or maybe a MAC school team. Maybe I'll go to Central, Eastern, Western. And then, 48 hours later, he's got coaches from Oregon, Alabama, et cetera, following him. And I think found a really good fit for himself at Wisconsin. But it's a great story, especially as now NIL is legal in the state of Michigan for high school players, that a lot of this stuff happens post high school, post development. That's a good story for kids to sort of hang their hat on and say, if it doesn't happen for you right away out of high school, there's a lot of Liams out there and Trinidads and guys like that.
Yeah, it really is one of the most remarkable stories of this transfer portal saga and year so far. Then also, I was wondering real quick, who are some of the players in this upcoming year who are kind of rising seniors now, who people should go out and look for and try to catch their game in the Metro Detroit area?
Yeah, so Dakota Grant from Harper Woods is our top guy in the state, and I think it's for good reason. I saw him play last, really, since his
It's cold outside.
Gash at Catholic Central. Gideon Gash is real. A lot of people know his brother, Samson, but I thought he made a name for himself in that state title game catching a bunch of touchdowns. Very sought after. Anthony Cartwright at Detroit Country Day, very heavily recruited. You know, really, really good two-way player, but going to be a tight end in college. So I think the 27 class is good. I think we're also really strong in 28 and 29.
Mm-hmm. I know we have a break coming up. Alan, you are such a wealth of incredible information. Would love for you to stay on for another segment after the break, if you have time for that. And I just want to get your opinion on how much recruiting with NIL, with everything that's happened, has changed during your time covering it. So we'll talk about that when we come back. You're listening to Gridiron Wrap. JR, the great voice of the Great Lakes. On Racked Up, WJR 760. And we are joined by a very special guest, Alan Trieu, who is the recruiting guru when it comes to high school and college sports. And one thing I wanted to ask you, Alex, and I hope I pronounced your last name correctly there. I want to make sure of that.
True, like true and false.
True. You are true, man. Yeah. So the one observation I've had about high school and college athletics over the years is when I was in high school back in the 70s, there was no limit on how many scholarships Division I schools could offer. I, in fact, had two high school teammates, classmates, get full rides to Pitt during the Tony Dorsett, Johnny Majors era when Pitt won a national title. And I think back then Pitt had 150 players on scholarship. And obviously over the years that has changed dramatically. And the way I've seen it is it's a trickle down. So a lot of those players that were getting D1 scholarships years ago are down to you know, what we used to call 1AA, D2, even D3. So the quality of college football on a whole is far greater and better than it's ever been. And so I guess I just want to get your opinion, you know, on the lower levels of college football and the talent of players. And we just had Tony Anise on, who you know well. And, it's really, and you've heard it over the years, if you're good, they'll find you, meaning college programs and the NFL, certainly. But I don't think that's ever been more true than it is today. And I'd just like to get your opinion on that.
Yeah, I think the other thing is the quality of high school football has risen greatly. I mean, I played high school football and these kids work way harder than I did or my teammates, and their knowledge of the game. I mean, the sophistication of high school offenses and defenses and the amount of training these kids do outside of these, some kids go practice and go have an outside trainer and all those things. So that's contributing to what you're talking about, which is a lot of talent out the deeper talent pool. So I think, you know, the great thing about the transfer portal, some people say it hurts high school recruiting. In my opinion, it makes it so that the journey's never over.
Right.
So that if you are a Liam Danitz and you have to go to Hope College out of high school, it's your only opportunity. Before, that was it. That was the end of the line.
Yeah.
Now, if you do the things you're supposed to do and you develop, there's always another opportunity out there. And so I think that it ends up being a good thing for players if you look at it that way. But no question, I think there's a deeper talent pool than ever before. And it's good for the schools like Ferris and Grand Valley because they're obviously being poached by some of these bigger schools. They turn over a lot of roster. But I think what's Coach Anise and that program going so well is there's always a next man up, right? Trinidad Chambliss was the next man up. He wasn't the starter. So he had to be ready to go. And they do a great job of making sure that they stockpile talent. And that's I think a little bit easier to do now with the depth of high school talent available.
I think that's a great answer and a great observation, Alan. And the other thing I wanted to ask you, and I really think it's applicable maybe at any level of football, collegiately or even in the NFL, is the incredible success that Kurt Cignetti had turning around the worst program, arguably, statistically, in college football history to a perfect season, national championship in 2 years. What impact do you think the pressure that'll put on the game, certainly at the college level, and perhaps even at any level?
I think it puts tremendous pressure on, because now any program can look at it and say, why can't that be us?
Yeah, right.
And I've cautioned people to say, and a lot of people say, well, I guess in the portal era, anybody can get good. Just look at Indiana. And I caution folks when they say that, of there's not a lot of Kurt Cignettis out there. And there's, you know, that was the perfect storm of talent and the right players and the right system and the right, honestly, staff too, because he has really outstanding assistants. So on one hand, I think it should give anybody hope to say, we can do that based on right. where Indiana was when he took over. And it doesn't take long. They did it very quickly. On the other hand, I think you have to be a little bit cautious about making that an expectation, because to me, this Indiana Kurt Cignettis story is kind of a Disney movie once in a...
Yeah. We may have lost Alan there. Technology.
Oh, something. I'm back. Okay. Yeah.
You're back.
Yeah. So I think if another program comes along and duplicates what Cignetti does, then you can start to say, okay, this right. is more realistic for us. But at the moment, with one data point, I don't think we can expect that.
What advice would you give, Alan, to, you know, high school athletes in general, certainly football in particular, that have dreams and aspirations to get where a lot of these collegiate and ultimately the very small minority of collegiate athletes that go to the pros? What advice, you're close to, as close as anyone, to the reality of high school sports and recruiting. What advice would you give to them?
Yeah, I always use a swimming analogy, because my daughter is competitive swimming, and one of the first things they tell you is, don't look over into the other lane.
A little technical difficulty.
Did I lose you guys again?
Yeah, go ahead.
Just swim as fast as you can until you touch the wall, so you reach the end. Because if you look over to the other lanes, you're going to slow yourself down. And it's like that in football recruiting. If Trinidad Chambliss had looked over to the other lanes when he was in high school, he would have said, well, how come they're getting recruited and I'm not? He just kept going, waited till he, you know, understood that I'm going to develop maybe a little bit later. I need to go to a place that's going to develop me. And he's ended up ahead of a lot of guys who had more offers, more articles written about them, higher rankings. And so that's the best thing that I can, example or advice that I can give, is when you're talking about teenagers, there's a lot of different development styles, and not everybody's ready made at 16, 18, even 20 years old. Just run your race and don't let the process frustrate you, because it can be very frustrating. And just keep going, because I see a lot of kids get derailed by saying, man, they're looking at everybody else but me.
Right. Now that's brilliant advice. And from someone that knows that reality in that world as well as anyone. You know, the other big news recently in the state of Michigan is the MHSAA now allowing NIL. What's your opinion, you know, your short version of the impact that's going to have on our sport?
My short version is there's very few kids I see that are good enough at the high school level to start making NIL money at that level.
Right.
So people should not think that that's just going to happen for everybody. Even if you have scholarships, doesn't mean you're going to make a ton in NIL yet. Most of the time, your NIL will come later. The NIL comes after you become Trinidad Chambliss, William Danitz, and those guys. It takes, you know, it takes some time. So very few kids in the state will be able to capitalize on that. And so if the expectation is a bunch of high school kids are going to start making money hand over fist and have all these deal endorsement deals and things like that, I don't really expect that to happen.
That's great advice. And I hope that resonates with a lot of the high school athletes that you come in contact with and we come in contact with. And Alan, I just think it's fascinating that you made a career out of this reality that, you know, has infiltrated the game of football. When did you, just a short, you know, biography, if you will. When did you start realizing that you could make a career out of being the most preeminent recruiting information person in the state?
It was just going to be a hobby. I started a draft blog when I was in eighth grade, actually.
Wow.
And ended up doing a little bit more high school, and then started with a company called Scout when I was a freshman at Grand Valley.
Wow.
And that became 24/7. And yeah. So it's been 20 years, but it started off just like in my dorm room. And so never thought it would develop into this, but yeah, it's been a ride.
Well, kudos to you, man. I mean, you're the Trinidad Shambliss of recruiting experts in many ways. To start in eighth grade, you know, I hope a lot of people hear that. And you've become the voice in the state of Michigan, certainly, if not nationally, when it comes to recruiting, especially when it comes to Michigan high school athletes. So, Alan True, we thank you for your time and wish you nothing but the best. And hopefully we can make your appearance more of a regularity in the future, certainly next season. So thanks again, Alan. And you are listening to Gridiron Wrap on WJR 760, the great voice of the Great Lakes. Welcome back to Gridiron Wrap. And just following a great interview with Alex True, the recruiting guru. That rhymes. How about that, Alex? but Alan really had some great information for us and a perspective that I think is should serve high school athletes in particular very well. And speaking of high school, the big news coming out of the MHSAA is that Michigan is following suit with many states and now allowing high school athletes to profit basically from their name, image, and likeness at the high school level.
Yeah, they're certainly not the first state to do this. They're one of the first states to do it, though, without the added incentive in there, because most other states that do it, pretty much you have to be committed to an in-state college to be able to benefit from that. That's how if you go back and look at a guy like Luther Burton, who's currently on the Chicago Bears, he committed to Missouri at the time, and that was a big deal because he's from St. Louis and he was able to start making money his early year of high school. But I think Alan really did kind of hit the nail on the head that most kids are just at the high school level. So unless you're one of these mega five-star, you know, Bryce Underwood level recruits, you're probably not going to really be bringing money in high school through NIL. But it is interesting. And, you know, if it truly is NIL in its pure form, the player should be able to make money out of it. If you're a high school athlete, is able to leverage your name enough to be able to make some money, I definitely think you should. But it's just going to be an interesting dynamic to see how it all plays out.
Right. I in preparation for this topic, which I'm not all that familiar with on the high school level, a local sports researcher, Joseph Penrod, who just graduated from Michigan State, sent me some interesting information on it. And the first state to adopt NIL, if you will, was California in 2021. Some of the local sponsorships, brand deals, YouTube, TikTok, you know, those business entities most affiliated with high school aged, students. But across the country, less than 1% of high school athletes secure significant NIL dollars. In North Carolina, for instance, the average NIL deal is only $60 to $120. So it's certainly new. Now there are some exceptions, obviously. There was a article, as Joseph shared with me in Sports Illustrated a year ago in Sports Illustrated of January of 25, where a couple high school athletes signed a deal, NIL deal of $600,000 to $700,000. So there's always going to be exceptions. But I think, you know, the reality, as Alan alluded to, it's very few. It's probably a comparable percentage of high school athletes that go on to play college sports that will receive this type of endorsement benefit financially. And again, the average deal in one state is only $60 to $120.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know that. The stats about that and how low some of the NIL deals yeah. are. I mean, as for a lot of them, it kind of makes sense because if it's just a player uploading like a singular post on an Instagram story or anything, that does seem like a fair market rate because you're not really doing much research and some not all players have big followings. Right. But yeah, it's just going to be interesting.
I think we may have lost Alex there. So some of the technical difficulties we were having with Alan have appeared again, but nonetheless, here he's back. He's okay. back. There you go.
Sorry about that. Yeah. A little technical difficulty there, but no, yeah. I was going to say, it's going to be interesting to see how it affects recruiting in the state of Michigan now, because you know, with this new factor, are we going to see some more kids go out of state and all that? Because there isn't this added benefit like the other states have, where if you're a high school player earning NIL money, you have to stay in state. Will more of these guys be able to get paid early on if they're in high school and make it, and then, you know, go to some other schools, maybe down mm-hmm. south or something like that? So it's just a lot of interesting factors and changing environments to college football that keeps happening.
Right. And I think our state athletic association does a really good job of monitoring the ever-changing, you know, reality of high school mm-hmm. sports. And I didn't realize that there were over 40 schools that had already implemented some version of this. Hmm. So obviously we did not jump the gun, so to speak. And I'm presuming here, but I think it's logical. We took our time and came up with a plan that we feel will be appropriate in these changing times.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very good point of how they definitely didn't jump the gun here. It's not like this is some landmark first
right.
State or school to do this, but it is just an interesting thing ultimately, because, you know, I think it's going to have more effects long run at the college level and with recruiting, yeah. but also, you know, I mean, are there any schools or coaches or anything that, you know, the fans and stuff care a lot where at the high school level, we're going to see a little bit of recruiting? Not sure, but you know, crazier things happen, right? There's already is some recruiting different levels and stuff within Michigan high school sports. So
oh yeah,
yeah. that might just ramp up even more, where again there's smaller deals, but you can still convince some kids to go other places.
Sure. And I, you know, as I said, I think the MHSAA is in great hands with Mark Yule, the executive director, who you know, has played sports. He had a son that won a state championship in football a few years ago. He gets it, and he understands the mission that he's been charged with. So I will forever believe that any decision made at that level will be one that has the best interest of the athletes and coaches and high school sports in mind. But nonetheless, did we ever think we'd be talking about, you know, what's happened in college football, let alone now at the high school level? I mean, 10 years ago, 5 years, whatever it's been, it's just remarkable how the world of sports is constantly changing. And that may be the most profound constant, is that there's always going to be change.
Oh, yeah. And especially with all this change, I mean, like you were saying, can you imagine talking about NIL and all this? Like, if that was on the Friday Night Lights TV show, you know, when that came out like 15, yeah. 20 years ago now, you mm-hmm. a few years ago, be like, all right, this is crazy, you know, out of the way. Like, who's ever going to pay a high schooler to come pay for your local team? But, you know, mm-hmm. it's becoming a reality, and not just in Texas or anything, because also when like a rule or law change comes up like this, it comes up for a reason. There's definitely some players who they were, you know, trying to and took this up with the MHSAA mm-hmm. because they were having the right to earn money. So it's, yeah, I'm going to be interested to see who are the first few athletes who get it. Is it just big time football players, or is it going to be even like, you know, smaller things and people getting recruited to other high schools?
Yeah, it will be interesting. And as it evolves, you know, maybe there's some goodwill that can come out of it. Maybe a portion of any monies paid to high school athletes can go to a local charity, a community mm-hmm. endeavor, a school aid fund of some sort. You know, it will evolve. That's one thing for certain. And I know in some small communities, not only in Michigan, but throughout the country, high school athletes are the most popular citizens mm-hmm. in those towns. They are heroes to the young people. And with that comes responsibility. And so if they're rewarded for some of that athletic achievement. Hopefully they can understand the role and position they have and the type of influence they can have on the younger students in, you know, junior high. Listen to me dating myself, middle school and grade school. And I know a lot of the senior high school athletic programs do go back to the younger grades in their community and try to be great role models. So we'll talk some more about that when we come back. We are at a break on Gridiron Wrap. You are listening to 760 WJR, the great voice of the Great Lakes. Welcome back to Gridiron Wrap on WJR 760. And time is flying by. It always does, Alex. Mm-hmm. And what we really haven't talked about yet is the biggest sports day in the world, the Super Bowl, coming up a week from today. The Patriots under first-year head coach Mike Vrabel and the Seattle Seahawks, who throttled the LA Rams last week. And it may not be what some consider a sexy matchup, but I think the storylines are incredible when you look at both teams, not the least of which Sam Darnold and a first year head coach in Vrabel with the Pats, who thought the Pats would be back as soon as they are. And it's just why the NFL is king and why we're so just consumed with football. And a week away, we'll have it all on display when the Seahawks and the Patriots take the field in San Francisco, Santa Ana.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited for it. Obviously, it's the Super Bowl. How couldn't you be, right?
Yeah.
But I actually do think it's going to be a pretty good matchup between the two teams. And the side of the ball that I think I'm most excited for, and probably is the story of the game, is going to be the Seahawks defense versus Drake May. Right. Because Drake May has played this year, the Patriots have ultimately had a schedule on the easier side. However, he put up some good performances in the playoffs to stay alive. He played, not only the Chargers, but then the Broncos and the Texans, who both have great defenses. But then the other thing that I'm really looking forward to see how he handles is when the Seahawks defense, when they blitz, Mike McDonald employs a system called the modular defense, right? So what he does is he teaches everyone on the defense, just using some basic numbers here, if there's 8 different alignments, everyone learns it, then 8 different types of pressures and 8 different types of coverages. Everyone learns all 24 of those things in total. But when you figure out all the combinations and permutations, that ends up being something like 5. If you had 8 of each, that'd be 512 different plays. So that's really just a creative thing that Mike McDonald does to get out and, make some creative blitz and stuff, but not use all your plays up on film throughout the year. So it's gonna be interesting to see how a young quarterback handles that type of thing, because there's no help on film necessarily for what you're gonna get or who's gonna be where. So that's probably one of the things I'm really looking forward to the most, especially those third and long situations. But what are you looking forward to in this matchup?
Well, I just think in a game like this, it's the team that can stay away from big mistakes early, because it's such an emotional reality. And we've seen games over the years where a mistake is made early, it just snowballs, especially with younger teams, younger players, younger quarterbacks. So if those teams can just hold the line, so to speak, each of them, I think we're in for a great game, a very competitive game. I don't think you can discount the experience that Coach Vrabel brings to the Patriots, having been there as a player so many times and understanding, the 2 weeks prior to the Super Bowl, so much is different from preparation. So the key is for the coaches to keep it as close to the same as they can, which may be impossible, but to make the game the most important thing and never lose focus and never allow for any of the external realities, responsibilities, media-wise, team-wise, just Super Bowl-wise, take precedent over the most important thing, which is the game. So I think it's going to be fascinating. And, you look at the season as a whole and, a lot of people, myself included, thought the Rams were on their way. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's ever been a team in recent memory that was so close and a play or two literally away from being in the big game than the Rams. When you look at, you know, they lose a game on a blocked field goal, they lose a game when they're inside the 5-yard line and the running back fumbles going into the end zone to win another game. But that's football. That is football. Mm-hmm. I remember back in 1983, the Washington Redskins had one of the greatest regular seasons ever. They lost two games, each by 1 point. And they were overwhelming favorites going into the Super Bowl against the Raiders. And the Raiders won in a runaway, like 38-9, I think the final was. But there were some key plays early in the game. There was a blocked punt. The Raiders blocked a punt and scored a touchdown on it. So the emotional, you know, back and forth of these games is critical. And of course, hats off to Sam Darnold. And that's an amazing story when you think about it. I mean, I was at the game at Ford Field. I worked the game for the NFL two seasons ago, the week 17-18 game, when both teams entered the game 14-2, the Vikings and the Lions, and were playing for home field advantage throughout the playoffs. And Sam did not have a good game. There's no other way of putting it. He missed a lot of open receivers, and I hate to pin it on him, but as a viewer of the game, if he had made just a couple of very makeable plays early, I think it would have been a much closer game. I'm not saying Lions wouldn't have won, but it would have been much closer. And now, less than how many months later, 13 months later, 14 months later, here he is at the pinnacle of the profession, a starting quarterback in the Super Bowl. So anything can happen, but the key is for the head coaches, and certainly Coach Vrabel has the nod of experience when it comes to that. Having been through it countless times, I don't even know the number, how many as a player, but he knows what to expect and what not to expect. And that'll be a benefit for the Ravens, no doubt. But Seattle has played better as the season has gone on. They're heading up the mountain, as we always talk about, and their defense is absolutely formidable. And, it really has all the makings for a great game.
Yeah, it truly does. And I mean, I also want to circle back something you said, because you were talking a little earlier about how the 2 weeks before the Super Bowl is so much different than the rest of the season. I was wondering if you could just go in a little bit with your experience in the NFL. Yeah. What are some of the things that are just different about Super Bowl week that the average fan and viewer doesn't really realize?
Well, I've been through both experiences. I've seen it where there's only 1 week in between. In fact, when I was working with Washington, it was a strike year, 1982, and because of 57 days, the league being shut down, games being canceled, etc., the Super Bowl was moved back a week, and we only had 1 week in between. Now, that was my first experience, so I didn't have a precedent to look back on. And even though the takeaway from that Super Bowl, it was at the Rose Bowl in January 30th, in fact, almost exactly to the day, was that it was overwhelmingly different and busy. And one funny story, or ironic story, from that game is we played Dallas on Saturday for the NFC Championship, and I flew immediately. I think it was Saturday, might have been Sunday. But anyways, I flew immediately after the game to LA to start the preparation for the Super Bowl. And one of my first assignments was to get to the Rose Bowl to meet the league PR staff and go over the lineups for the flip card, for the official lineups. And I meet with the NFL PR department, and we're going over our lineup. And Jim Heffernan was the NFL's director of PR, and he introduced me to his intern. And I go, "Nice to meet you." It was Roger Goodell. So how about that?
That's crazy.
Yeah. So that was the first time I met Roger. But anyways, what I came away from that Super Bowl was just the magnitude of it, how busy it was. But the truth is, it's nothing compared. That was nothing compared to what it is today. And having experienced both options, you have some people that wish it was only 1 week. I think it needs to be two. There's so much more media attention to it. And especially in this era, the players have played more games, you know, than they've ever played in their life since the season started. 17 regular season games, although the preseason's different. There's no question that the 2 weeks allows them to get healthier, not healthy necessarily, because I think no player is 100% at this time of the year, but it allows them to heal a little bit. And the magnitude of the game, it's so big, it's scary. And so there's a lot more that I'll explain after our final break of the day, I think. It is Gridiron Wrap on WJR 760, the great voice of the Great Lakes. Well, Alex, it's the fourth quarter. We are in our last segment of the year, and it's gone by so fast, and it's been so much fun. And first and foremost, I'd like to thank Skinny Butcher for its support. If you haven't tried the Crazy Dippers, the grilled chicken nuggets, do it. You'll be hooked. Great protein snack. And certainly everybody at WJR for their support. Jeff Marcero, Ann Thomas, Steve Finerati, Finitari, and just the whole staff in the station. Just an honor to be on the great voice of the Great Lakes. And we don't take that lightly. The season's coming down to an end with the Super Bowl, but the NFL will remain king as far as news. And this past week, something we haven't talked about yet was the Hall of Fame and the Bill Belichick situation. My initial reaction to it is it April 4th? Okay. I wait a minute. This isn't April Fool's Day. It was incredulous to me because I full admission, I had not recalled that the Hall of Fame had changed the time frame for head coaches. You know, shame on me, but I didn't know that. I didn't recall that. So I'm like, wait a minute, has he been out 5 years? No, he hasn't. Mm-hmm. So it dominated the headlines for a few days, if not the whole week. And one takeaway I have from it, and I want to get your opinion, obviously, but the irony of it, if there is an irony, is that I think Coach Belichick became a sympathetic figure. Mm-hmm. And I think people felt bad for him. And I think because of the injustice, and I think it is, by any measure, there's no way, by every definition, the winningest coach in the history of a sport, I shouldn't say the winningest, the most Super Bowls should not be a first ballot Hall of Famer. Don Shula obviously is the winningest coach in the NFL. Coach Belichick is number two. But it's ironic that in many respects he became a sympathetic figure. And I don't think there's any question there will be subsequent discussion about the format change that led to this this happening.
Yeah, I mean, if Bill Belichick isn't the first ballot Hall of Famer for a coach, no one ever should be at that point. Like, it was just crazy that he did not get in. I mean, it is ultimately hard for coach to get in. Like, let's be honest here. Mike Shanahan isn't even in the Hall of Fame yet.
Yeah.
But Bill Belichick 100% should have. He won 6 Super Bowls as a head coach, 2 as a coordinator. This vote had nothing to do with the football at all, right? This is just that during their reign of dominance, the Patriots ultimately ruffled some feathers, to put it pretty bluntly like that. So I think this, it was kind of a domino effect where I believe the Pro Football Hall of Fame announced he missed it by one singular vote. So you had enough people who were kind of just sitting there and be like, I don't want to give him the joy of being a unanimous decision, right? First ballot Hall of Famer and all that most likely. And the numbers just kind of added up for him not to get in there, but I do agree. And I think he put it really good ways. He did become a sympathetic figure because of this, but if I was running the Pro Football Hall of Fame, This is just not a good look, right, for the museum. Like, he deserves to be in ultimately, and it's wild that it's even a storyline, it's something we have to talk about.
Right. I think if you want to get another opinion of this situation, Google Jimmy Johnson's opinion on Bill Belichick. He was probably the most, emotional in his disdain and dislike for the decision. And as far as the Spygate component, he even said, every team did it. We tried it. We weren't very good at it. But there's so many sub stories to this. Why? Hopefully, you learn from mistakes. You learn from things that don't go as you planned. I don't think there was any, I don't want to use the word malice, but I think it was a perfect storm of a situation that caused this to happen. And, I was doing a little research this week regarding Coach Belichick, and the most astounding, accomplishment that I found comparing him to his counterparts is, as a head coach, Bill won 31 playoff games. Mm-hmm. There are only four teams in the NFL history that have won more.
Wow.
In their entire history. I mean, that is astonishing and sort of overwhelming. And I hope that this opens some eyes, and the accomplishments are for what happened on the field. And, the Spygate thing, he was penalized, the team was penalized. But if you eliminate that entire year from the record books, he still dominated.
Yeah.
And I want to share a funny story about Spygate on the heels of what Coach Johnson said, that all the teams were doing it. But back in 1990, when I was with the Lions and we were playing a game at Old Milwaukee Stadium, County Stadium in Milwaukee, against the Packers. Packers used to play three home games a year there. And because of the baseball configuration, both teams during the game were on the same sideline, on the sideline opposite the press box. So the near sideline was supposed to be clear, clean, except for some network photographers, camera people, etc. So the game starts, and the field's right below us, obviously, and I'm looking, and I'm noticing that the Green Bay near side corner and safety are looking over to the empty, and I say that parenthetically, empty sidelines. And then I notice a rather large individual dressed nondescriptly is making eye contact with these people. His back is to the press box, and it's however many feet below us. But then I'm intrigued by this, and I see it's happening before every one of our offensive snaps. Okay, so we get to the line of scrimmage, the quarterback, Bob Galliano, whoever it was, Rodney Pete, and I look down and I see this interaction between the near side defenders for the Packers. And then I start following it, and then it hits me that this guy, whoever he is stealing our signs, because he's looking right at our Miles Davis, who was the offensive coordinator, signaling in the signs. And he's relaying the signs to these defenders, these Packer defenders. And, one mistake I regret is I didn't pick up the phone to the TV truck and tell the producer, put a camera on this guy. You'll get the greatest TV ever. And it would have been. It would have been a story on ESPN. But I was so competitive for the Lions, obviously, that once I was convinced what was happening, I just sprung up and ran to the coach's booth where June Jones was our offensive coach in the booth in contact with Miles on the sideline. And I go, June. And I pointed at the guy, he's still on our signs. Look. And then June just said, now it makes sense. They knew something was awry.
Yeah.
They knew something was amiss. So June tells Miles, Miles tells Wayne, there's a timeout, the officials meet. And the next thing you know, who the guy was a Packers player who was on the roster but injured for the game.
Wow.
So he gets escorted off the field, and there was nothing ever made of it. Okay. So that was 1990.
Wow,
so anyways, it just conjured up that memory So I wanted to share that, but yeah, hopefully that will, be a one-time, you know, sort of off the track mistake. And, Coach Belichick undoubtedly, will be honored as he deserves. So, so Alex, again, I just want to thank you, for your support this year. Your intelligence when it comes to sports and football is unparalleled for someone early in their career. And, I just think we're very fortunate to be talking about this great game. I mean, there's nothing that is more lifelike, that personifies the reality of living in life, than the game of football.
Yeah, no, completely. And I've loved, thank you for doing the show as well, because I've loved this show, being able to talk football every week and, you know, doing it through some crazy comebacks like that Broncos Giants one happening live on air. And then when the Cowboys upset the Eagles in Dallas, you know, had some big ones. But yeah, it's been fun, and especially to cover not just the NFL or even high levels of college football, but really just kind of talk about everything, you know, whether it was talking about some standout high school performances when that was still going on, or, you know, our weekly GLIAC updates and all that. It was just a really fun show. And, you know, it's sad because, you know, you're gonna miss it when football is over and these upcoming weeks. So, but no, it's been a fun season.
It really has. And we are so blessed in this state to have the football that we have. Certainly the high school level, the emotion, the passion, the Friday Night Lights reality to all these small communities. I mean, I'm full of goosebumps right now just thinking about it. And then, you know, the small colleges, you know, the Adrian colleges and Hope and you know, so many, Kalamazoo College, just all the small college. And then the GLIAC, which is one of the best D2 conferences in the country. And what Ferris State has done is unprecedented. And to end our season, if you will, with Tony Anise as a guest and with Alan True as a guest, two individuals that in different ways contribute so much to the game of football and to the interest in football and to our love of the game, that we're just fortunate. We're so fortunate. And you know, a final thank you, another thank you to Skinny Butcher for its sponsorship, and to everybody involved. And at the top of the list is Danny Cahalan, our producer extraordinaire, who is the MVP of the show, I assure you, because we don't get on the air without Danny. And if you're listening to Sports Wrap, Lomas Brown's big show on Monday nights, he's the producer for that show as well. You know, thanks again, thanks for everything. And you know, we'll hopefully see you next year on Gridiron Wrap. This is the great voice of the Great Lakes, 760 WJR.